We have the privilege of meeting Ken B. from Pleasanton, California. His home group is the Men's Single Topic in Oakland. He has over 40 years of sobriety. And one thing that I really like here is he's also part of our, or used to be part of our NorCal H&I, and he might go into sharing that a little bit more. Can we give it up to a friend with over 40 years of AA experience?
Hey, woo!
Right on, right on.
So my name is Ken, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety birthday is October 15th of 1980. I do have over 40 years of sobriety. My sponsor's name is Bill Spencer, and he knows I'm his sponsee. We have a good relationship. And in fact, I just plugged into the chat room, the website or the contacts for meeting tomorrow night where he'll be sharing at the meeting that I kind of take care of, make sure keeps going on. It's called Care of Fig. It's a men's group. So sorry, ladies. But all you guys on here, I'd love to see you there. You hear my sponsor share his piece. So my story begins probably like most of us as a child in that, you know, and the thing I like to point out about my circumstances is that, you know, my family tree, as I heard it said in this room very happily, is that, when you shook my family tree, bottles fell out of it. And that pretty much meant, you know, that, I was exposed to alcoholism and alcoholic drinking from a very young age. And certainly, you know, as quickly as I could, I began to drink. My idea of drinking wasn't to be social, but to get drunk. And that's what I planned on doing, and that's the way I went, as quickly as I could, and as soon as I could. And I don't really quite remember when my first drink happened, because it was kind of a gradual process. But by the age of 12, I was definitely drinking like an alcoholic. And by the age of 14, I was blacking out and experiencing all those things and all those consequences to behavior. I was quite the juvenile delinquent. I was in and out of the boys, in juvenile hall and boys camps. They couldn't keep me in the boys camps because it didn't have fences. So I would, every time they stuck me in one of those, I'd walk away. So I was raised in an environment that was very toxic, very difficult. Unfortunately for me, we talk a lot about things and, you know, we use language like trauma and such like that. Nowadays, they didn't have those kinds of conversations back then. They didn't have those kinds of circumstances back then. But I had a lot of trauma in my life. As an 8-year-old, somebody who was a stranger, you know, accosted me very horribly. And, my life was pretty scarred at a very early age. And I found out that, I was very violent when I got drunk, if I was provoked. I'm not that big of a man. I'm 5'5". I was 5'6". I haven't been in a fight in a long time, but I fought like a Tasmanian devil, and I was just insane with my behavior when accosted. So I experienced life in this kind of like void of situations there. And as a teenager, I had this gut, this hole in my gut. And, we call it in the program, or at least I've heard it called, a God-sized hole that I was trying to plug with alcohol. And that's what I did for a good while there. And the problem with alcohol, at least for myself, was is that the results of that drinking was is that I did not mature. I did not have any real growth in an emotional sense. I stayed as a very small child, as I continued to get bigger and bigger as a person. And my violence continued to get worse because I was living in this world. And, and I've heard it aptly described inside the rooms of the program. This is that, I felt like a pile of shit, but I believe the whole world should circle around me and recognize me and acknowledge me and think the wonderful things about me. My behavior was of such a nature that people, more often than not, were just disgusted with me. And so by the time I was 16, 17 years old, I just about went to juvenile hall and into CYA, the youth authority. But I got caught a break and went to live with my father up in Washington State. And that was all nice and dandy because I thought that was pretty cool because my dad was a partier. And I was the official joint smoker for the parties. I mean, joint roller, excuse me, and joint smoker. But I was the official joint roller at the parties. And I was pretty darn good at that, too. After about 3-4 months of me being around that party crowd, all of a sudden, he realized that I was not the same kind of drinker that most of the people in that room were. I was very insane. I would act very, very bizarrely if provoked at all. So finally he just started having to shove me out of the set. He says, I don't want to see you drinking. And then he tried to explain to me what social drinking was about. And he told me, you drink enough candy to just get a nice little buzz going on there. And then you drink only an ounce of liquor every hour to keep that buzz going. And I looked at him like he was absolutely out of his mind because there was nothing about that kind of idea that sounded like any kind of a reasonable drinking party to me. It was like if I was going to go get drunk, I was going to get as absolutely smashed out of my mind as I could possibly make it. And that was just the way that my life was. And certainly, as I said, my family, and that's the way most of my family lived. My father had long divorced my mom. So I continued on this way, and I pretty much managed to alienate myself from everybody and anybody around me. So by the time I was 19 years old, I was out on my own. My dad, I'd walked away from any responsibilities, and I was just hitchhiking around the country. And I would hitchhike from Washington State, where my father lived, all the way down to Texas and back and all the way places in between. And I was just traveling around as if with no responsibilities at all. And as a 19-year-old kid, nowadays hitchhiking isn't that common, but back then, you'd see a whole lot of people out on the with their thumbs out. And so I did that. And there, I had plenty of people that would want to just say, hey, you want a beer? Do you want a joint? You want something? You want something to snort? And so I lived a pretty good party life without any responsibilities or any accountability to it at all. And it became quite isolated and feeling like nobody really cared anything about me. And I felt like that if whether I lived or died, it didn't matter. So, I continue to get bounced in and out of jail, and I get in trouble, drunk in publics, assaults on people. And finally, it came to the point where I did what I didn't think I ever do, and I took somebody's life. And so by the age of 19, May 7th of 1978, I was facing a life term. And they took me to prison, and I realized that there was something seriously wrong with me, but I didn't know how to fix it, and so I got to the place where I was going to start doing my time in the California prison system, and I remember very clearly this was what happened with my last drink. I was standing on one of the hallways where I was doing my prison term, and I saw a bunch of guys. They were all standing down at the end of the tier, and they all had their cups in their hands. I knew what was in the cups, and so I walked down there, and one of the guys handed me his cup, and I took a big swallow of this prison wine, and this guy could cook good prison wine. He was the vineyard of the prison. He could take it and make it. I mean, it had a great taste to it, and it had a really, really good kick to it. And it went down smooth and hard, and immediately that compulsion to drink swelled up in me. And I thought to myself, yeah, I want to get good and smashed. But as quick as that reality, as that idea came up into my mind, there followed it this moment of clarity, as we called it in the program of AA. And it said to me that if I drank while I was in prison, I was either going to wind up on death row, or I was going to die. My options had just shrunk down to that. We talked in the program about it being jails, institutions, and death. Well, I'd already been in the prison. I really know, and it's like, you know, and I knew that my life was just not, it was not going in the right direction. So I didn't drink anymore. But I did take and, you know, utilized other substances. And I continued to do that. But, you know, I went in front of the lifer recommendation hearing the first year after the first year I was in. And I'd gotten some things accomplished while I was in there, and I was staying sober. So even white knuckling it, we as alcoholics can do some pretty good stuff. I always like to ascribe to us this overachiever mentality as an alcoholic. I got my GED within the first 3 months I was in, and I was getting involved in other things like electronics and stuff. And I used to fix TVs that had vacuum tubes in them. So if you don't know what a vacuum tube is, ask your grandmother. You know, but still that restlessness and irritability was going on in my life. And I was using other substances to kind of tamp that issue down. I remember my date of sobriety is not from the last drink I took, but I counted from the last thing that I took that changed, altered my head and altered the way I thought about things. And so that was on October 15th of 1980. So, you know, the thing that happened to me was is that when I walked into the room of Alcoholics Anonymous inside of the prison that I was at, was that these people that came into there, they were called Hospitals and Institution Worker Committee, H&I. And they quite literally saved my life because they shared with me the idea of hope that I had not really encountered before that. I had not really understood that there was a way of living with alcoholism that didn't require me to drink, didn't require me to have this mindset that the only thing that could tamp down and make me feel like I was comfortable in my own skin was another drink. And so, you know, I started listening to what they were sharing. And these people didn't necessarily have the same kind of background as me. There was a few people that did time and stuff like that. But a lot of the other ones were, they were businessmen. They were housemakers, women. And they were all sharing about their lives and their experience and their strength and hope in a way that just simply really resonated with me. And it told me I could have this too. I could have a good life. I could have something that was meaningful, that had purpose, direction, and meaning to it. And this is, to me, is what the gift of the program is about. I want to say, you know, shout out to the ladies in the recovery rooms. You know, I really want to tell you that as far as what I was told in my first year of sobriety is that if you count out your sobriety, okay, 5 years from where you're at right now, and if you work the program the way that it's supposed to be, if you lay it out and you do all the things, and you write down in there and you say, this is where I want to be at in 5 years of sobriety, they told me I would sell myself very short on what I could actually accomplish. And I found that to be very, very true. And I still do. If I start to project out what I can do in 5 years from then, you know, it's just unbelievable. And the gifts of this program are amazing. And it may not necessarily be all the cash and the prizes, but it certainly includes on a very big scale relationships and friendships and meaningful, deep relationships and friendships that I've acquired inside of the prison system and outside of the prison system. And so, and the other thing that I did while I was in there was I got involved in therapy. And, we talk about outside issues in this program and about trauma. And as I told you, I had a lot of trauma in my life. And so I was dealing with and working with a doctor. And he was the therapist, and he was an old school doctor. He'd been 30 years in the prison system by the time he started working with me. And I remember when I came up on him about my first year of sobriety, and I was, and I've been working with him on, over that whole period of time. And what he shared with me, he says that, you know, when I first met you, I didn't think you were going to make it. As a matter of fact, I thought you were pretty much sure to just completely collapse and just you know, devolve, either be dead or on death row, just like I thought I would be. But now you've got it. And whatever, I don't know what that it is, but, you know, keep it. And, you know, we talk about in this program that we can do inside of the AA halt work, you know, AA rooms, you know, miracles, and they are miracles, in 3 months that years of work by people outside of us, years of work by people who are trying to help us to stay sober, therapists and stuff like that. All of those things, when we don't have this core of sobriety in our life, are meaningless, and they really just do not affect us the way that they should. And so he said, you know, and he you know, definitely encouraged me to keep it. And I did. And I continued to do the things that I was supposed to be doing. I continued to work the program. I started to live a good sober life inside of the system. H&I back then, back in that day, as some of the H&I that I know are here today, they contest that they don't do that now, is that H&I used to come in to visit me. And they had all, you know, if they go to a meeting on Friday and come to see me on Saturday. And so I had a lot of time and a lot of mentoring going on from the old timers of the AA program inside of the prison system. We would talk a lot of fellowship, you know, outside of the meetings as well. And, you know, and occasionally I would have a sponsor on the site. But what I also did was I got into the textbooks, the 12 and 12, the big book, As Bill Sees It, and other books like that. AA Comes of Age, which somebody was talking about earlier. These are books that talk about our history. They talk about the program. They talk about, you know, what it means to experience sobriety. They give us stories from personals. They give us, you know, they give us the story and the history of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And studying that material is really the foundation, as far as I'm concerned, about what sobriety is. If I want to know how to stay sober, more than anything else, I go to the text and I study it and I read it and I read it over and over again. Because as I've heard it said many times in these rooms, it just all of a sudden the words change every now and then, and they all of a sudden mean different things to me. It's like somebody's rewriting the text as I read it. And that's a good thing, because I, you know, at every place and point, and I believe it's God's power in my life, says I, you know, God meets me right where I'm at, right where I need Him at, and the way I need. And so, and He's always done that, and it's always been the case in my life. So, I got involved in a lot of things. I got involved in what I came to know as my higher power. I was going to the meetings in the visiting room. We'd have to take all our podiums and everything else that we were using for the meetings. We'd have to bring them back to this room, one room where Bible studies were being held. And I got involved in that. I got into faith in a God that of my understanding. And I can tell you is that, you know, whatever your description of that higher power is, you know, at least I'll speak to this in terms of what my belief is as a higher power should be, is that it's somebody who's bigger than I am, knows me through and through, forgiving, definitely, compassionate, very loving, and wants the best out of my life 100%. And that's my idea of a higher power. And that kind of idea, I think, is what carries most of us in this program. And that gift of an understanding and a faith is what this program tells me is the thing that's going to keep the stay and stand between me and possibly the next drink. Because of my own means and methods, as I've shared with you just a minute ago, I wound up in prison on a life term. And I did not want to come back for that. So, you know, working what this program has given me, you know, they started, you know, I continued to apply myself in various ways, in various groups. I got involved in various trade programs. I became an electronics technician. I became a computer draftsman. I was a computer operator. I could type to over 120 words a minute at one point. I'm a little slower nowadays, but I applied myself. And I kept pushing things forward. And I kept making meetings. I kept attending the program. I kept on being involved in things. I kept my prayer life up. I kept my devotional life up. I kept all these things in gears. And I won't say that I did it perfectly by any stretch of the imagination. And none of us do as far as I can see. But I did what I could do, the best I could do it. And the rewards were phenomenal. You know, and it's like, more than anything else, while I was in prison, you know, the miracle that was given to me was peace of mind. And it was an opportunity to live a good, productive life inside of a hellhole. And, you know, and the pastor, Bible study teacher that I had, he described prison as a place that sin built and hate runs. And I think that's a pretty accurate description of it. And it can be very ugly and it can be very, very dangerous. You know, the thing that program has also taught me, and I applied that inside of the prisons as well, is I stuck with the winners. You know, I didn't want to hear the guy down the tier who was talking about, you know, how much dope he slammed the night before, or how much he used to have out on the streets, or how much he used to do this, how much money he had on him, or what he was doing, and all these other, these all stories of glory that they had while they're in there. Those are the things that it really didn't impress me, you know, and it was like, you know, what impressed me was, how are you doing as far as your sobriety today? What's going on in your life, and what do you need to fix? And I was applying these things in various ways, and in various programs, you know, and it works. There's a whole, you know, if any of you know anybody in prison that are telling you there's nothing to do, I'm going to tell you right here and straight now, that is not the case. There is a lot that can be done to apply yourself inside of a prison system to make your life better, make yourself into a better human being. So I pushed forward a little bit on my program here, and eventually I wound up transferring in 1993 to San Quentin State Prison. I know it's not quite the vicious place it once was. It had been mellowed out quite a bit. And San Quentin, as far as the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, has a lot of history. It has, you know, the program of the H&I who bring in meetings all through the Northern California, started their program of Alcoholics Anonymous inside of San Quentin. And I always love to mention the fact that, you know, there's two H&I groups outside in the parking lot of San Quentin, and they got in a fist fight over who got to bring the meeting in. Yeah, I like that. excuse me, wrong pipe. So I went down and transferred there in 93, and I kept on pushing my life forward, doing the things, employing myself in the ways I did, could, and I got employed as a captain's clerk at the prison, Now, one of the captains that I work for, her name is Jeannie Woodford, and she's also very involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and very supportive of the program. And so I clerked for her and I worked for her, and she went on and promoted up, and she became the warden of San Quentin. And as soon as she became warden, the one meeting a week at San Quentin turned into five, and so she really was very big on the program, and I felt good to be, you know, able to offer this program at more involved level. Eventually she also became one of the Alcoholics Anonymous trustees for the International Program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, it was really amazing was that a couple of years ago, she spoke at a conference, and I was asked to introduce her at this particular conference. And it was kind of cool, and it was very nice, and I knew her very well, and we had a great talk before the meet, before the share. And what was really freaky about it was hugging a warden on the stage. I can tell you that right now. But we're still friends today. We have a good relationship. And the thing that I started doing, and I found a love for and compassion for it while I was in there, because when a person gets sober, they really find a whole lot of purpose outside of the program of AA for their lives. And they can apply themselves in amazing ways. One of the ex-cons, I won't mention names or anything like that, this girl is she came out of the prison system herself in the 10 years of sobriety. Now she's working on a PhD, and it's not the first one that I've heard of. And you know, you ladies in those homes, I think you can do the same. So, you know, I started writing while I was in there, and I found out that I really, really liked that a lot. And the thing about writing, I'll talk about, and if you get a sponsor and he or she tells you to journal, I think you really ought to consider doing that. You know, writing, as I described, is untangles my thoughts. And it really, when I can see my own thoughts on my piece of paper there's something about that magic, about that transference, for me, anyways, that really does amazing job in my brain. And it kind of sets things in the right way. And sometimes in places I don't do enough of it myself. So, you know, I've been married by 2007, I've been married about 16 years. And, you know, the wife had been wore out on it. It didn't look like I was ever going to get out of prison. And so she decided to bail on me. And my life kind of hit a skid. And I was, you know, really made a question about things. And I really had to ask myself, what was the point of all this? And, you know, why should I even keep on going? And, you know, and the reality is that I think that most of us in this program will find ourselves in that spot one time or another, where we're really saying, is this all there is? And the thing that I can tell you about it, and at least not speak for myself again in my own personal experience, was that the thing that dragged me out of it was turning around and getting back into service on a more deeper level. And one of those services that I did, one of the things that I was asked to do was to become the editor-in-chief of the San Quentin newspaper. They decided that they were going to start it back up after 20 years of it being out of print. And the warden of the time asked me if I would become the editor-in-chief and take it up. So I did it. And you know, and I've become such a valued clerk while I was there. And I, you know, I did my job with diligence, responsibility, maturity, and honesty. And so when they asked me to start working on this paper, I did it with equal value, equal effort, equal things. I did it with honesty, with integrity. And unfortunately, that meant putting things in that newspaper that the people I used to work for didn't want to hear, didn't want to see, and it got I caught a lot of flack behind that. And that's okay too, because I was living life on life's terms then. And I was not afraid of the future. I didn't think I'd ever get out, so I could care less. You know, I was like, I say, okay, what are you going to do? Kill me? You know, I thought that probably you know, there was a very likelihood that they bounced me out of the prison because of it. But that was okay. I was going to do my job and I was going to be responsible. And that's the gift of this program. And I had to step back from that after a short period of time. But San Quentin newspaper is alive and it's going on big time right now. I got copies of it right now in the cell. In my room, sorry. It's a great paper. They wrote about the program of AA back in the day. I had the privilege of writing about the program again here and now. I was given a good life. I was given opportunities to do things that actually, in many ways, most of my family outside who never did any prison time or anything had not even gotten close to. You know, so when I stepped back from the paper again, I kept on writing, and I became very good at my writing, and I started winning national prison writing awards for some of the work that I was doing. And I became a published author. There's an author named Joyce Carol Oates. She is world famous, and she selected one of my stories for publication. And I'm kind of rolling back down around here, and I got about 15 minutes left on this share. When I talked to Jim about this share to begin with, I thought I was going to come in here and do a 20-minute share, and I was going to say, okay, fine, I can do that. And then he said, no, it's going to be 45 minutes. And I said, oh, this is an Earl Hightower share then. So I guess I'll have to bump it up a little bit here. And I hope I'm making him proud. But, in 2013, right around then, you know, things started really shifting. I started seeing a whole lot of people who were walking out the door, people who also thought to themselves that they would never get out. And so, you know, I mean, I've done a lot of preparation while I was in, and I've gotten a college degree, and I've been, you know, and I got my writing, I've gotten all these things to put together and all my ducks in a row. And I put together, and I participated in some other programs that I've suggested to me outside of the program. And suggestions, by the way, to me are very important because, humility, which is very important in this program, really to me is at its very core, is being teachable and being able to listen to somebody else. And that's the key to what I think sobriety and having an open mind involves. And so, you know, I started doing other things that were suggested to me as well and participated. Sometimes I dragged my heels. Sometimes I didn't want to be a part of it. I felt like I'd already accomplished that, and I didn't think that it hadn't done me any good before, so why is it going to do me any good now? But I bit the bullet, and I kept on, and I went and I did these things again. And so in 2017, I went in front of the parole board the 22nd time, and they gave me a parole date, and they said I could go home. And on August 20th of 2017, I walked out the door of free man after serving 39 years incarcerated. And I can tell you this world out here wasn't the same one that I had come into. I mean, I had left. It was very different on many levels. And but working the program, applying myself in a responsible, mature way while I was in there paid off, and it paid off big. Because as when I came out of the prison system, I had over 35 years, my math sucks on this moment, but I had over 35 years of sobriety. And I also had many, many friends in the H&I, you know, circles and stuff like that. And I was welcomed out into this world out here from the program of AA in a very big way. And they gave me, opportunity to experience the program of AA as like I'd never had before. We had a few select meetings inside there, but there wasn't a whole lot of options. And the neat thing about what happened with me, this is neat, because I broke two bones in my foot. The neat thing about that is that I couldn't work for 3 months, and so I had people carting me around to meetings all over Oakland where I paroled to. And I was going to meetings. I was going down to meetings down in the in-between fellowship where they, you know, it was the rough side of the program, if you say. And you could go into the room and you could say, how many of you guys in this here got felony convictions? And probably about half the audience would raise their hands up and, yeah, that's me. And then you go over to the other side of the town and over to the Rockridge Fellowship, which is, down in another area. And you'd ask, you know, how many people in this room got PhDs? And about half the people would raise their hand. And this program is a mix of everybody. It is, you know, from the big ones to the little ones. We got people from every walk of life in here. I see on YouTube, all kinds of different celebrities and stuff like that. I won't name them, but they're out there. And they acknowledge their sobriety, and we've got most surprising at all, we got some famous rock stars in our program. I met a few of them while I was in San Quentin, as a matter of fact, that are got clean and sober time. And, I started to learn how to live life on life's terms out here. And the big thing that kept me going and the big thing that kept me supported was the meetings in these rooms and making the meetings and being a part of them and being responsible. I have my, as Jim mentioned, I have my home group, this men's single topic. It meets every Tuesday night over in Oakland. And you can find it on the web. You can go to the meeting on Zoom. It's there for you to attend. And the guys in there, I love them to death. We talk serious program. And we have a good time doing it, too. And we definitely have a really, really fun time doing it, too. Anybody who tells you that we're all doom and gloom in these meetings, you don't see the smiles on our face then. Because we're living life. We're having a life. We have everything in this life that I know for a fact that none of this would be possible without the sobriety I got now got. And so one of the things that happened with me is that when I finally started going to work, first job I had, you know, it was physically impossible for me to keep doing it. My hands started swelling up. I was working in a machine shop. I had to go and tell them I quit. I can't do this. And so I went to my next job, and it was a job driving a forklift. They told me to go get on that forklift and start driving it. So I drove it, and then 2 weeks later, they says, you're fired. You can't drive a forklift. And I told them I'd never said I could. You know, and so I told that to my home group. And, you know, a guy come up to me after the meeting, and he says, you know, I run a business 150 strong. And he says, I'm hiring you. It's like, just like that. It's fantastic, you know. So I got called the next week and told to come up, and they wanted to, was going to go to lunch and talk about the job and stuff. So the guy who talked to me at the meeting, and my, you know, friend of Bill's as well, he was there, but also the guy was sitting across from me, and he was the owner of the company. And he looked, and he says, you know, I looked at your resume. He says, I see 30 years of hard work on your part. He says, and I want to help you too. And, you know, and fast forward real quick to where I'm at right now, is that I'm part-time at this job because of other things that I got going on, I'll tell you about. And it looked like I was going to be quitting there altogether, and I had already given the owner that, you know, my notice. And then I realized I couldn't do it. And so I had to come back to him and tell him, you know, I says, you know, I still need the job. And he says, you always had a job here. And that's a gift of the program. And so, you know, I started working there, and I started, you know, and I kept on making meetings, and I kept on going for the program. I'm now living where I'm at in Pleasanton, as you see, because of my job and everything like that. But prior to that, I was still living in Hayward. COVID comes along. And, you know, and it's like, you know, it was interesting to watch as people had to adjust to this. It wasn't that hard for me because I'm already used to the idea of lockdown. It says it has quite different definition to me on a big scale. And, you know, I don't see this particularly, probably as, I don't see it anything like probably most people out here do. You know, the restrictions that they were having me, and you can't do this and you can't do that, it's a lightweight stuff, you know. But I understand the hopelessness. Because when we were locked down inside of the system, it's like, you know, there are uncertainties there. You don't know what's going to happen next. You don't know how things are going to unfold. You know, the rumors are going around, crazy as all. Everybody's trying to make light of the situation while everybody's obviously scared to death of what's happening. You know, and I'm talking about prison, not about this. But I think they correlate to each other very clearly. You know, the program AA was there. Very quickly, it went from nothing to Zoom. And Zoom has been amazing. It's like I have talked all over the world. I mean, this has been fantastic. On Sunday morning, I just did a 20-minute share in London, and I've shared more than a few times in across the pond, as they call it, and I've really had a great time experiencing the richness of what this program is about, the many, many different ways that it unfolds, the way that people that have their meetings in one place and another, the differences in the way that they talk even bring out different aspects of the program for me. And I just love to hear kind of like their way of looking at the particular elements of the program, and I've been having a ball with all of this. And it's been a fantastic honor to be a part of this program and what it has given me. And I want to go back to what I said before. This program gave me everything I could possibly hope for under circumstances that I thought everything would be impossible to get. So I think that, you know, being out here in this world and working this program under these circumstances, living life on life's terms is just as valuable out here. It's a rich program. It's an amazing program. And it just keeps on giving. That's what it comes down to. And, you know, and so So I'm very grateful for what I've been given in this, and even just fast forwarding all the way up to just the present time right here and now. I'm in Pleasanton, and I just lost a job because they took me from being this contract worker into, and I was doing for 6 months, and they tried to make me an employee, and they did the background check, and they says, even though most people knew the details, that after they looked at the background, said, nope, can't hire you. And I lost a job on Monday. And, so what? These are, I call these Cadillac and caviar problems. Because I've already had my share of complete disaster in my life. And I think that I speak for many people in the program, where we've been through hell on such a level that, when I'm having to deal with these kinds of problems, these are lightweight. These are just, living life on life's terms. When I'm focused on the program. Now, when I'm focused on Kenny and when I'm focused on poor me, I can become very, very whiny, gripey, and pissy and moaning. And I start to lose focus on things. But when I get out of myself and I start being of service and I start doing things, I start helping other people. And it's amazing how quickly the problems go away when I stop looking at them and I start doing something else. And then they fix themselves, fantastically without my help on many levels. And that is a promise of this program. That we will do things we could not think we could do before. And we can, and we have this intuition about us and this ability to understand things in a way. And the thing else I could tell you about as far as this 40 years of sobriety I got.
I might have misspoken to you on the phone, but we're going to try to wrap up the meeting at 7:55 if we can.
Got it. No problem. Okay, sorry. I was looking at my timer here. So thank you for letting me share. It is an honor to be here. It's a great program. Keep coming back. It works. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken.